This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people on whose land we're meeting tonight and recognise their vibrant and ongoing culture. I'm Michelle Hetherington, and I'd like to welcome you also to the Studio Gallery, the National Museum's newest gallery. I'm the curator of Exploration and Endeavour, the Royal Society of London and the South Seas, and I would like to introduce our two performers tonight. Rhys Muldoon.
Hello.
And Andrew Sayers, the Director of the National Museum. And they will be reading a selection of letters and documents from the archives of the Royal Society in London that are on display here in this exhibition. Exploration and Endeavour celebrates the 350th anniversary of the founding of the Royal Society of London in 1660, the year in which Charles II was restored as Britain's monarch. The Royal Society was keen to promote useful knowledge and asked its fellows to draw up sets of directions for gathering information on various subjects which might, if followed correctly, answer some of the pressing questions of the age. Lawrence Rooke was asked to draw up directions for seamen bound for far voyages, and which he supplied in 1661. For an island nation dependent upon the navy for defence, any discoveries that could improve navigation would be very useful indeed. The king, who styled himself founder, patron, and fellow of the Royal Society, had appointed his brother James, Duke of York, as Lord High Admiral. Under James's guidance, the Admiralty adopted Rooke's directions. As a result, over 250,000 captain's journals are now held in British collections, providing an extraordinary record of global weather conditions since the 1660s.
Directions for seamen bound for far voyages. One, to observe the declination of the compass or its variation from the meridian of the place, frequently marking with all the latitude and longitude of the place. Two, to carry dipping needles with you and observe the inclination of the needle in like manner. Three, to remark carefully the ebbings and flowings of the sea in as many places as they can. Four, to make plots and drafts of the prospect of considerable coasts, promontories, islands and ports, marking the bearings and distances as near as they can. Five, to sound and mark the depth of coasts and ports and such other places near the shore as they shall think fit. Six, to sound and mark the depths of the ocean in several places. Seven, to take notice of the nature and the soil of the bottom of the sea in all soundings, whether it be clay, sand, rock, etc. Eight, to keep register of all changes of wind and weather at all hours, by night and by day, showing the point the wind blows from, whether strong or weak, the rains, hails, snow, etc., the precise times of their beginnings and continuance, especially hurricanes and spouts, and above all, nine, to take exact care to observe the trade winds, about which degree of latitude and longitude they first begin, where and when they cease or grow stronger or weaker. 10. To observe and record all extraordinary meteors, lightnings, thunderstorms, ignis fatui, comets, etc., marking still the place and times of their appearing, continuance, etc. 11. To take up seawater in several places, 200, 300, or 400 fathoms deep, to compare the weight and saltiness thereof with the water upon the surfaces. 12. To keep an exact diary containing these things mentioned, and all other ordinary observations relating to the ship's course, and all such extraordinary things as occur, and at their return unto England, to deliver one copy of their diary, finely written, and their course pricked upon them, out upon their card, for His Royal Highness the Duke of York, and another to Trinity House, to be perused by the Society at Gresham College.
The first reference to the Australian continent in the Royal Society's archives is in a letter written in 1698 by Nicholas Witsen, a director of the Dutch East India Company, Burgomeister of Amsterdam and Fellow of the Royal Society, which he wrote to his friend Dr. Martin Lister, also a Fellow. Witsen's letter summarises the report he received from the Vlaming Expedition's 1696-97 voyage along the western coast of New Holland, which located and mapped the Swan River and Rottnest Island. Witsen, celebrated throughout Europe for his magnificent Kunstkammer, had hoped Vlaming would bring him back new specimens and treasures for his collection. He was to be sorely disappointed, as his letter, which contains the first descriptions of marsupials and black swans, shows.
On this voyage, nothing has been discovered which can in any way be serviceable to the company. The soil of this country hath been found very barren and as a desert. No freshwater rivers have been found, but some saltwater rivers, and also no four-footed beasts, except one as great as a dog with long ears, living in the water as well as on the land. Black swans, parrots, and many sea cows were found here, as also a lake whose water seemed to be red because of the redness of the bottom of it, and round along the shore there was some salt. Our people have seen but 12 of the natives, all as black as pitch and stark naked, so terrified that it was impossible to bring them to conversation or a meeting. They lodged themselves as the Hottentots in pavilions of small branches of trees. By night our people saw fires all over the country, but when they drew near, the natives were fled. The coast is very low, but the country far from the sea is high. Upon the island near the coast have been seen rats as great as cats, in innumerable quantity, all of which had a kind of bag or purse hanging from the throat, from the breast downwards. There were found many well-smelling trees, and out of their wood is to be drawn oil smelling as a rose. But for the rest, they were small and miserable trees. There were also found some birds' nests of prodigious greatness, so that six men could not, by stretching out their arms, encompass one of them. But the fowls were not to be found. There was great store of oysters, lobsters and crabs, and also strange sorts of fish. There were also millions of flies, very much troubling men. They saw a great many footsteps of men and children, but all of an ordinary bigness. The coast is very foul and full of rocks.
In 1716, Astronomer Royal Edmund Halley's admonition to his fellows at the Royal Society was published in its scientific journal, The Philosophical Transactions. Halley urged lovers of science to observe the next eclipse of the Sun by the planet Venus, due in 1761, so that the Sun's diameter could be measured and the distance from it to the Earth calculated. The 1761 transit of Venus was observed from locations in Europe, South Africa and China, but the results were not conclusive. The Royal Society resolved to make the most of the next transit due in 1769. Any proposals for the improvement of navigation were likely to find favour with the reigning monarch, George III.
And to the King's Most Excellent Majesty, the memorial of the President, Council and Fellows of the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge humbly showeth that the passage of the planet Venus over the disk of the Sun, which will happen on the 3rd of June in the year 1769, is a phenomenon that must, if the same be accurately observed in proper places, contribute greatly to the improvement of astronomy, on which navigation so much depends. That several of the great powers in Europe, particularly the French, Spaniards, Danes, and Swedes, are making the proper dispositions for the observation thereof. And the Empress of Russia has given directions for having the same observed in many different places of her extensive dominions. That the like appearance after the 3rd of June 1769 will not happen for more than 100 years. That the British nation have been justly celebrated in the learned world for their knowledge of astronomy, in which they are inferior to no nation upon earth, ancient or modern. And it would cast dishonour upon them should they neglect to have correct observations made of this important phenomenon. That a correct set of observations made in a southern latitude would be of greater importance than many of those made in the northern. But it would be necessary that the observers who were to pass the line should take their departure from England only in the spring, because it might be some time before they could fix upon a proper place for making the observation within the limits required. That the expense of having the observations properly made in the places above specified, including a reasonable gratification to the persons employed and furnishing them with such instruments as are still wanting, would amount to about £4,000. inclusive of the expenses of the ships, which must convey in return the persons that are to be sent to the southwards of the equinoctial line and to the North Capes, that the Royal Society are in no condition to defray this expense, their annual income being scarcely sufficient to carry on the necessary business of the Society. The memorialists' attention to the true ends for which they were founded by Your Majesty's royal predecessor, the improvement of natural knowledge, conceived it to be their duty to lay their sentiments before Your Majesty with all humility and submit the same to Your Majesty's royal consideration.
The King, eager to discover and claim the great south land believed to lie in the Pacific, gave his approval to the Royal Society's petition in less than a week, giving £4,000 as well as making a Royal Navy ship, HMB Endeavour, available. The Admiralty's choice of captain, Lieutenant James Cook, known as a skilled astronomical observer, was engaged by the Royal Society as one of the two astronomers on board. Accompanying Cook was Joseph Banks, Fellow of the Royal Society since 1766, and his scientific party. The presence of a civilian scientific party on a royal naval vessel did not convince the Portuguese viceroy at Rio de Janeiro that their voyage was for scientific purposes. HMB Endeavour and those on board were placed under armed guard, while fresh water, provisions and wood were taken on.
Rio de Janeiro, 30th of November, 1768. Sir, I take the opportunity of a Spanish packet, bound from hence to Europe, to acquaint you of the arrival of His Majesty's bark, the Endeavour, under my command at this port on the 13th instant, and that having recruited our water and stock of provisions, shall put to sea again without loss of time, being now in as good a condition for prosecuting the voyage as the day we sailed from England. Neither Mr. Green nor myself hath been able to make any observations worthy of the attention of the Royal Society. No one gentleman in the ship have been permitted to go ashore at this place. This unheard-of treatment has not only prevented Mr. Green and myself from making any astronomical observations here, but Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander from collecting any of the productions of this country. I am not at a loss to assign the true reason the Viceroy had for treating us in the manner he hath. Notwithstanding several memorials and letters have passed betwixt me and him on the same subjects, he only pleaded custom and the orders of his court. The account we gave of ourselves, of being bound to the southward to observe the transit of Venus, a phenomenon they had not the least idea of, appeared so very strange to these narrow-minded Portuguese that they thought it only an invented story to cover some other design we must be upon. This, I believe, to be the reason for the unpresidential reception we met with here. I am, sir, your most obedient, humble servant, James Cook.
Joseph Banks could afford to be much less diplomatic than Cook. He wrote to Lord Sandwich urging the Navy send warships to bombard Rio and avenge the insult to British honour, commenting that the Portuguese defences were, in his opinion, pitiful. He also wrote to his friend William Perrin, expressing his great frustration at being confined to the ship.
3 weeks have I been lying at an anchor in the river, the banks of which are crowded with plants, animals, etc., such as I have ever seen before. All this time I have not been permitted to set my foot upon land because, forsooth, the gentry here think it is impossible that the King of England could be such a fool as to fit out a ship merely to observe the transit of Venus. From hence they conclude that we have come upon some other errand which they think to disappoint. Oh, Perrin, you have heard of Tantalus in hell. You have heard of the Frenchman laying swaddled in linen between two of his mistresses, both naked, using every possible means to excite desire. But you have never heard of a tantalized wretch who has borne his situation with less patience than I have done mine. I have cursed, swore, raved, stamped, and wrote memorials to no purpose in the world. They only laugh at me and exult in their own penetrations to a defeated, so deep-laid a scheme as they suppose ours to have been.
Despite the guard set over the Endeavour, Banks acquired a number of botanical specimens at Rio that were drawn and classified and then engraved in the years following the Endeavour's return to England in 1771. These specimens were just a tiny portion of the vast collections Banks formed during the voyage, which, combined with the excellent maps Cook created, represented major improvements to scientific knowledge. Plans for a rapid return to the Pacific were soon underway. Banks intended to sail on this expedition too, but after additions made to HMS Resolution at his request and expense were removed, they'd made the ship unseaworthy, he and his large party of scientific assistants withdrew. In his place, and on the advice of Daines Barrington, the Admiralty engaged the services of Johann Reinhold Forster and his son Georg as the expedition's scientific gentleman. As the expedition was returning home, and mindful of Barrington's assistance, Forster sent him a letter from Cape Town with advance news of the Resolution's voyage. Barrington, Fellow of the Royal Society, promptly forwarded the information to Charles Blagden, Fellow of the Royal Society and Joseph Banks's personal physician, and cautioned him not to mention Captain Cook's negative comments about Omai, a young Polynesian man who had been in Banks's care since 1774.
Daines Barrington to Charles Blagden, 26 June 1775. Dear Sir, Captain Cook arrived at the Cape on the 22nd of March last after a voyage of 28 months without having lost a single person by sickness, and on the contrary, the whole crew were in perfect health on their arrival. This is attributed by Forster to the use of sauerkraut and wort from malt. They have discovered many new islands, some of which were 80 leagues in length and have penetrated to 71.10 south latitude, west longitude 106.5. Forster hath collected 260 new plants and 200 new animals that they are so, he pronounces very positively. The landscape painter hath sent over many views of these newly discovered islands, which I am told are masterly. The Otaheite man was put on shore again and proved incorrigibly stupid, which Captain Cook says he is the more sorry for, as Omai is a very great blackguard. You must not, however, tell your patient of this, as perhaps he may call Captain Cook behind Buckingham House on his arrival, which is expected every hour. Ever yours, D. Barrington. Captain Cook says that Kendall's watch, together with the lunar tables, proved a most faithful guide in all difficulty.
James Cook was proposed for membership of the Royal Society on the 23rd of November, 1775. His election certificate was then made available over 10 consecutive meetings for members to add their endorsements to. Cook's proposers, led by Joseph Banks and Daniel Solander, had reached 24 in number and filled the available space on the certificate when Johann Reinhold Forster added his name in the space between the two neat rows. On the 29th of February 1776, Cook's name was balloted and he was duly elected, paying his fee of 5 guineas and signing his bond before being admitted as a Fellow of the Royal Society on the 7th of March 1776.
Captain James Cook of Mile End, a gentleman skilful in astronomy and the successful conductor of 2 important voyages for the discovery of unknown countries, by which geography and natural history have been greatly advantaged and improved, being desirous of the honour of becoming a member of this society, we whose names are underwritten do, from our personal knowledge, testify that we believe him deserving of such honour, and that he will become a worthy and useful member.
On the evening that Cook was admitted as Fellow of the Royal Society, his paper on the methods he had used to preserve the health of the Resolution's crew was read to the assembled fellows. Scurvy, a disease now known to be caused by vitamin C deficiency, was a curse of long sea voyages, when fresh food was often unobtainable. Mortality rates from scurvy were so high that vessels regularly carried extra men in the hope that sufficient of them would still be alive at the end of the voyage to bring the ship into port. During his first Pacific voyage, Cook had 2 skilled botanists, Banks and Solander, on board who could identify edible plants. As a result, the crew of the Endeavour had remained remarkably healthy until the fevers at Batavia carried a third of them off. Keen to build on the knowledge gained from this voyage, Cook experimented with a variety of methods to keep his crew healthy on his second Pacific voyage, on the Resolution from 1772 to 75. He was awarded the Royal Society's prestigious Copley Medal in 1776 for his documentation of his methods of preventing scurvy among his crew.
To Sir John Pringle, President of the Royal Society. As many gentlemen have expressed some surprise at the uncommon good state of health which the crew of the Resolution under my command experienced during her late long voyage, I take the liberty to communicate to you the methods which were taken to obtain that end. A good deal was owing to the extraordinary attention paid by the Admiralty in causing such articles to be put aboard as either by experience or suggestion were judged to tend most to preserve the health of seamen. I shall not trespass upon your time in mentioning all these articles, but confine myself to such as were found the most useful. We had on board a quantity of malt, of which was made sweet wort, and given to such of the men as showed the least symptoms of the scurvy, and also to such as were thought to be threatened with that disorder. This was without doubt one of the best anti-scorbutic sea medicines yet found out, and if given in time, will, with proper attention to other things, I am persuaded, prevent the scurvy from making any great progress for a considerable time. But I am not altogether of the opinion that it will cure it at sea. Sauerkraut, of which we had a large quantity, is not only a wholesome vegetable food, but in my opinion, highly anti-scorbutic, and spoils not by keeping. A pound of it was served to each man, twice a week, and oftener, if thought necessary. Portable soup or broth was another great article, of which we had a large supply. An ounce of this to each man was boiled in their peas 3 days in the week, and when we were in places where vegetables were to be got, it was boiled with them, and wheat or oatmeal every morning for breakfast, and also with peas and vegetable for dinner. It enabled us to make several nourishing and wholesome messes, and was the means of making the people eat a greater quantity of vegetables than they would have done otherwise. Rob of lemons and oranges is an anti-scorbutic we were not without, and the surgeon made use of it in many cases with great success.
Cook's assumption that diet played a major role in scurvy was correct, but his non-dietary remedies were also important.
But the introduction of the most salutary articles, either as provisions or medicines, will generally prove unsuccessful unless supported by certain regulations. On this principle, many years' experience, together with some hints I've had from Sir Hugh Palliser, the captains Campbell, Wallace, and other intelligent officers, enabled me to lay a plan whereby all was to be governed. The crew were at three watches, except upon some extraordinary occasions. By this means, they were not so much exposed to the weather as if they had been at watch, and had generally dry clothes to shift themselves when they happened to get wet. Care was also taken to expose them as little to wet weather as possibly could be done. Proper methods were employed to keep their persons, hammocks, bedding, clothes, etc., constantly clean and dry. Extra care was taken to keep the ships clean and dry betwixt decks. Once or twice a week, she was aired with fires, and when this could not be done, she was smoked with gunpowder mixed with vinegar or water. I had also frequently a fire made in an iron pot at the bottom of the well, which greatly purified the air in the lower parts of the ship. To this and cleanliness, as well in the ship as amongst the people, too great attention cannot be paid. The least neglect occasions a putrid, disagreeable smell below, which nothing but fires will remove. And if these be not applied in time, these smells may be attended with bad consequences. Proper attention was paid to the ship's coppers, so that they were kept constantly clean. The fat, which boiled out of the salt beef and pork, I never suffered to be given to the people, as is customary, being of the opinion that it promotes scurvy. I was careful to take on water wherever it was to be got, even though we didn't want it. Of this essential article, we were never at an allowance, but had always plenty for every necessary purpose. I am convinced that with plenty of fresh water and proper attention to cleanliness, a ship's company will seldom be much afflicted with the scurvy, even though they are not provided with any of the antiscorbutics before mentioned. These, sir, were the methods, under the care of Providence, by which the Resolution performed a voyage of 3 years and 18 days through all the climates from 52 degrees north to 71 degrees south, with only the loss of 4 men of 118. 2 were drowned, 1 was killed by a fall, and the other died after a long illness occasioned by a complication of disorders without the least mixture of the scurvy. I have the honour to be, sir, your most obliged and humble servant, James Cook.
Unwisely, as it would turn out, Cook turned down the offer of a comfortable retirement to return to the Pacific for a third time in 1776. He was killed at Kealakekua Bay in Hawaii on the 14th of February, 1779, when his attempts to retrieve his ship's cutter went horribly wrong. News of Cook's death reached London in January 1780, and at their next meeting, the Council of the Royal Society, headed by its president, Sir Joseph Banks, resolved to honour Cook's scientific achievements with a suitable memorial. They created a medallion in his honour. The Latin motto placed beneath his portrait on the medal's obverse translates as "The Royal Society of London, his society." In addition to the hundreds of silver and bronzed copper Cook medallions produced for the Society, a small number of gold medallions were minted for presentation to significant individuals. One gold medal was reserved for Captain Cook's widow, Elizabeth. Mrs. Cook conveyed her thanks in a letter to Joseph Banks. "Sir, I received your exceeding kind letter of the 12th and want the words to express, in any adequate degree, my feelings on the very singular honour which you, sir, and the Honourable Society over which you so worthily preside, have been pleased to confer on my late husband and, through him, on me and his children, who are left to lament the loss of him and be the receivers of those most noble marks of approbation which, if Providence had been pleased to permit him to receive himself, would have rendered me happy indeed. Be assured, sir, that however unequal I may be to the task of expressing it, I feel, as I ought, the high honour which the Royal Society has been pleased to do me. My greatest pleasure now remaining is in my sons, who I hope will ever strive to copy after so good an example, and, animated by the honour bestowed on their father's memory, be ambitious of obtaining by their own merit your notice and approbation. Let me entreat you to add to the many acts of friendship which I have already received at your hands that of expressing my gratitude and thanks to that learned body in such a manner as may be acceptable to them. I am, sir, with greatest respect, your greatly obliged and very humble servant, Elizabeth Cook." Joseph Banks's role in the choice of New South Wales as the site for Britain's penal settlement was considerable. He received regular gifts of natural history specimens from his clients in the Navy who were based there. One gift was the pelt and bill of a platypus, one of the most extraordinary creatures discovered by settlers in New South Wales at the end of the 18th century and brought to the attention of scientists in England. Initially considered a hoax, the platypus was the subject of a paper by Sir Everard Home in 1800, who described the creature's duck-like bill and accepted it as genuine. The following year, Home dissected a preserved female specimen sent to Sir Joseph Banks. In a 38-page paper, read before the Fellows of the Royal Society on the 17th of December 1801, he described its anatomy in great detail, paying particular attention to the creature's reproductive organs.
Here we go. A description of the anatomy of the Ornithorhynchus paradoxus by Everard Home Esquire, read December 17, 1801. The peculiar characters of the Ornithorhynchus as a genus, or more properly a tribe of animals, are the male having a spur on the hind legs, close to the heel, the female having no nipples, the beak being smooth while the rest of the animal is covered with hair, the tongue having horny processes answering the purposes of teeth, the penis of the male being appropriated to the passage of the semen, and its external orifice being subdivided into several openings so as to scatter the semen over an extent of surface while the urine passes by a separate canal into the rectum. The female, having no common uterus and the tubes which correspond to the horns of the uterus in other quadrupeds, receiving the semen immediately from the penis of the male. These characters distinguish the Ornithorhynchus in a very remarkable manner from all other quadrupeds, giving this new tribe a resemblance in some respects to birds, in others to the amphibia, so that it may be considered as an intermediate link between the classes mammalia, aves, and amphibia. Between it and the bird, no link of importance seems to be wanting.
Sailing home to England in December 1803, after his circumnavigation of the Australian continent, Matthew Flinders was captured by the French and spent the next 7 years imprisoned on Mauritius. 2 weeks after his capture, Flinders' papers and observations were returned to him, and he resumed work on the troubling phenomenon of compass deviation. This could throw a vessel off course by up to 7 degrees. Flinders was the first to realise that this hazardously variable error was actually predictable. He proposed a mathematical law to quantify the magnitude of the variation, and he also suggested a remedy. The vertical iron bar he recommended should be placed near a ship's compass still bears his name today. Flinders communicated this vital information to Banks and the Royal Society in a letter dated the 3rd of March, 1804. On the 5th of July, 1805, he sent a second letter on the subject.
Sir, about 12 months since, I sent you a short account of some observations of the variation of the compass made upon the coasts of New Holland and New South Wales during my examination of them in His Majesty's ship, the Investigator, which showed the variation to differ considerably on an alteration being made in the direction of the ship's head. Since that time, I have further digested these observations, and as far as a slight knowledge upon the subject of magnetism and my present confinement, which precludes access to further information, will permit, have brought my opinion upon the cause of these differences towards maturity.
In his earlier letter to Sir Joseph Banks on compass variation, Flinders had added the following plea.
I have too much ambition to rest in the middle order of mankind, and since neither birth nor fortune have favoured me, my actions shall speak to the world. In the regular service of the Navy, there are too many competitors for fame. I have therefore chosen a branch which, though less rewarded by rank and fortune, is little less in celebrity. In this the candidates are fewer, and in this, if adverse fortune does not oppose me, I will succeed. And although I cannot rival the immortalized name of Cook, yet if persevering industry joined to what ability I may possess can accomplish it, then will I secure the second place. If you, Sir Joseph, as my guardian genius, will but conduct me to the place of probation. The hitherto obscure name of Flinders may thus become a light by which even the illustrious character of Sir Joseph Banks may one day receive an additional ray of glory. As a satellite of Jove, I may reflect back splendour to the gracious primary, who by shining upon me shall give lustre to my yet unradiated name.
And it
well
did.
Done. Okay. All right.
And
so that's it.
That's it.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.